This is not fireworks. It's a carefully engineered act of science. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
This was before anesthesia, so all of the surgeries were all done on people who were wide awake.
It was hard to come up with something that just wasn't sort of invoking magic.
Then to me, it suggests that the universe is much more about the dark matter than it is about us.
The two-dimensional plane is the dance floor,
and the
particles are the dancers.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organs.
Unfortunately, the data didn't pan out that way, exactly.
Not as problems to be solved, but as human beings.
On today's show, mouse parenting and what we can learn from it. You think they're into that tiger mom thing? Also, the mystery of the ailing smallmouth bass comes to a head and getting to the bottom of return customers at the ER. But first up, 15 seconds. That's all it took to raise a 16-story public housing high-rise in Philadelphia last weekend. Only an implosion, an uncommon but highly precise form of demolition, could take down a building so fast and provide such a visually stunning demise. But how does it all work? We asked Aaron Moselle to find out.
In just a matter of seconds on Saturday, Queen Lane Apartments vanished from the sky. A nearly 60-year stay in Germantown over in less time than it takes to wash and dry your hands. Neighbors cheered as a khaki-colored cloud of dust briefly billowed over the scene before revealing a four-story-high pile of bricks and concrete. The short spectacle was, of course, carefully engineered. Jim Santoro with Controlled Demolition, Inc. is one of the guys who made sure all the right strings were pulled at the right time. He says the goal is to get a building to collapse into itself and almost entirely within its own footprint. If you've never seen an implosion, it looks like a building is melting to the ground.
We do not blow buildings up. What we do is use a very, very small quantity of explosives to disrupt a column's ability to support the building. If we remove those in a sequence and in a form marching back through the building, we can actually control the timing and the rate of failure and the direction of fall. Gravity does 99.9% of the work you see when you see the building coming down. It really had very little to do with the explosives when you see that building breaking up.
Before the demolition, a building must be completely gutted, but its bones are otherwise left intact. Nothing is pre-weakened before the implosion. Then, a day or two before the main event, Santoro's crew drills a series of holes into carefully selected columns throughout the building. Remember the old Roadrunner cartoons? Sticks of dynamite, similar to those red Lynx Wile E. Coyote used, are then concealed inside the openings to sever specific columns. At Queen Lane, less than a pound of explosives were placed at each of the roughly 426 locations throughout the high-rise. That total was dictated by what else? Science.
You use a certain quantity of explosives in order to disrupt a certain quantity of concrete. We can go through and we can estimate how much we're going to use. Based on our experience and the rebar configuration in the building and the hardness of the concrete, we'll adjust that load either to make it a little bit heavier or a little bit lighter.
Most of the dynamite is loaded on the lower levels, especially the first floor. That's where the greatest amount of drop happens during an implosion. Once the foundation goes, gravity takes over and the rest follows. Also, the lower levels are detonated first so that there's a debris pile to cushion the tower's top floors when they fall toward the ground. Or put more simply, the bottom goes first, the top rides down over it. Jim Santoro says during an implosion, dynamite is detonated at split-second intervals thanks to a series of pre-programmed delays. Those more muffled booms you're hearing are columns being severed, about a third to a half a second apart.
From one column to the next, the timing of the detonation is to allow for the building to start to fail and drop and allow the beam connection between columns to start tugging on the column behind it so that when it goes off, it keeps pulling the building in a continuous motion in the direction you want it to fail.
But there's another part of the equation that Santoro has to account for, the impact of all this debris hitting the ground.
Instead, it's coming down as hundreds of thousands or millions of small pieces of debris, each striking the ground at a different moment.
That means building implosions don't cause very much vibration. In most cases, not even enough to knock a secured picture off a wall. The process is so precise that only neighbors within a one-block radius of the tower had to evacuate their homes the day of the implosion.
Timing is everything, especially in the demolition game.
The science behind building implosions really started developing in earnest in the decades leading up to World War II, and really took off after it. Blasters started refining the technique while taking down bombed-out buildings in towns across Germany and England, buildings that had to be removed without compromising other structures. In this newsreel from the early 40s, blasters are shown imploding a four-story building in Prague.
But it's the birth of a brand new product, instant rubble.
Back then, there were two reasons to use explosives. One was you're blowing up a structure that you can't reach otherwise, that there's really no other way to do it. And the other is to bring down a large number of structures in a timely manner.
Brent Blanchard is director of operations for Protech, a South Jersey-based vibration consulting company. He's also one of the only people who has a working knowledge of structural demolition history.
It's just more expeditious to perform building implosions than it is to run around and piecemeal demolish hundreds of structures after World War II.
He says building implosions in the 40s and 50s were effective, but a bit clumsier than what's seen today.
You didn't have explosives placed in the same precise places that you do now. You also had different construction materials back then. You're blasting columns that were made of brick. I mean, there wasn't reinforced concrete back then. There were no steel beams in many cases back then. So you were more pulverizing and obliterating columns than you were trying to defeat a few columns to get a controlled collapse.
Over the next few decades, though, building implosions became more refined as commercial companies got into the blasting biz. Blanchard says the military made that private industry possible by showing city governments that building implosions could be done safely in tight quarters. That comfort level has grown still thanks to advances in technology.
Then you started to have a lot more control over what you're detonating and over how the structure reacts. So that was one of the main technologies that changed. Now there's non-electric technologies. Now there's wireless technologies. So now you don't even need to have wires running to the building. It's all remote control.
Still, these days, an implosion is not the only way to take down a tall building. Using a high reach, for example, a type of crane equipped with a pulverizing arm, a building can be safely deconstructed floor by floor. That, says Blanchard, means there are fewer implosions being done today than even a decade ago. But he says, don't expect to see the building implosion industry become rubble anytime soon. It'll always be the fastest and the most fun gun in the West. For The Pulse, I'm Aaron Mozell.
Marla, look at me. I'm really okay. Trust me. Everything's gonna be fine.
You remember that movie scene, right? And if you want to see pictures and videos of this feat of engineering, the implosion in Germantown, we got them on our website, whyy.org/thepulse.
Try this trick and spin it. Yeah. You have a collapse, but there's nothing in it. And you'll ask yourself, where is my mind? Where is my mind?
Scientists often toil for years and years under the fluorescent lights of their dusty labs without the world ever taking much notice. But one discovery and sometimes just one phone call can change all that and drag them into the spotlight. Danielle Bassett got that kind of a call this week. She's been selected as one of 21 MacArthur Fellows. Usually they are referred to as genius grants that are given out. Each recipient gets $625,000. Dollars to pursue their work, no strings attached. Bassett was selected for her research on the brain and learning, and she joins us now on The Pulse. Danielle, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
So I want to talk to you about your work. You are a physicist by training. How did you get interested in the brain?
That's a really good question. Yes, I am a physicist by training. I was trained in math and physics from college all the way through graduate school and postdoc. But all the way through, I was also very interested in medicine in general and psychology and psychiatry in particular. And along the way, I was really looking for ways in which I could mold these two loves together with one another. And in my graduate work, I began to put them together in roughly the framework that I'm using right now, which is applying tools from network science, which is a traditionally mathematics and physics-based discipline, to understanding how the brain works.
And what exactly is network science?
Network science is a very interdisciplinary field. It draws from graph theory and mathematics, statistical mechanics and physics, computer science, statistics for inferential modeling, and it puts all of these tools together in a way that enables us to look at complicated systems in a very different way. So these complex systems are composed of independent pieces that then interact with each other in very heterogeneous ways.
And you're trying to figure out how the network works?
Exactly, the network of our brain. Yep.
So what exactly are you interested in when it comes to our brain?
At the moment, I'm really fascinated by learning. So I'm interested in how the brain network configuration changes when our behavior changes, so when we learn a new skill. So what I'd like to be able to do is to understand how the brain evolves to enable that change, and then how we could optimize it. So how could we actually enhance learning in an individual based on what we know about what happens in healthy people?
How do you go about studying that? What does a typical experiment look like?
A typical experiment would be bringing healthy individuals into an MRI machine, and we take images of their brain as they're learning something new. So one of the experiments that we have, for example, is individuals coming in and moving their fingers in a way that's similar to learning piano pieces or piano arpeggios, and they practice these arpeggios over and over and over again and get faster and faster and better, and we watch how their brain changes as that skill becomes learned.
And what do you see? Do specific areas light up? Do they light up differently?
Yeah. So the different areas definitely light up differently. What we're actually trying to understand is which regions are communicating with which other regions. So not just what's lighting up, but where is the processing actually happening? Which pieces are talking to which other pieces? So we create a network composed of individual parts of the brain and then how they talk or interact with each other.
And what are you seeing so far?
So far what we're seeing is that there's huge amounts of reconfiguration in the communication patterns in the brain over time. And as people learn, what we're seeing is that people who are very good at learning have very flexible brains whose network configurations evolve or reconfigure very quickly. And then people who are less able to learn are those who have very rigid brains who are not able to reconfigure their networks quickly.
And you can literally see this happening in the brain through
yes,
the MRI?
That's right. Yes.
What do you see? Does it just get red or yellow?
No, so we see connections moving in and out between different parts of the brain. So we see rapid reconfiguration of networks. So think of social networks, right? So individual people and how they're connected up, those networks change drastically. They reconfigure very, very quickly.
So this really is a highly, highly, highly sophisticated computer we have up in there.
Yes, it is.
Does that amaze you? You've been doing this for a while, but seeing this miracle in action?
It is amazing and fascinating. I mean, there are just so many questions that it opens up, but it'll definitely keep me busy for many years.
And how does our brain know to do this? What do we know about when we learn, how to learn, and then that we perhaps should be flexible about it?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. And that's something that we're trying to answer in different disease cohorts. So asking whether people who have difficulty learning because they have a particular disease have different strategies of reconfiguration. That's something we haven't really quite figured out yet, but we're beginning to ask those questions. And the MacArthur would definitely enable us to do that.
And you touched on some of the possibilities for this research, but what do you kind of hope will come out of this? What's your big picture idea?
Yeah. So I have two big picture ideas out of this research. One is that we want to be able to optimize a healthy person's learning. So how do we enhance learning in a healthy person, knowing what we know about these reconfiguration processes? But secondly, we'd like to be able to identify intervention strategies in neurorehabilitation to help people who have had brain injury or other neurological disorders learn better.
But how could we – it seems like our brain – does this without our knowledge, so to speak. So is this something we could consciously influence mm-hmm. if we knew, you know, I don't know how to activate one particular region of my brain or get it to talk to another region.
Mm.
So how could we translate this into kind of better learning?
I think it's number one by creating new environments potentially. So asking whether a certain learning environment is enhancing brain flexibility or not enhancing brain flexibility is one way to do it. Another way is to focus on specifically in rehabilitation, are there particular areas of the brain that we can intervene in? So stimulate, for example, externally that would then lead to enhanced reconfiguration or flexibility. So those are the two targets I think that we can access.
Do you have any idea how your name got tossed into the MacArthur hat?
I do not know. It's a very secretive process that nobody will tell me how it happened. So I don't know. I will forever be in the dark.
What do you plan to do with this influx of both, I guess, wealth and also attention to this kind of research?
Mm. I think the attention to the research is great because I think this is a really promising area of scientific endeavor. So the more attention on it, the better in, from my perspective. But in terms of the funding, I think that what we're going to do is to use it for some sort of crazy ideas that we have that would not be funded by traditional sources of funding for scientific research, but that we think have a lot of potential.
Danielle Bassett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Danielle Bassett is an assistant professor in the Department of Bioengineering at the University of Pennsylvania, and this week she received the prestigious MacArthur Fellowship. Coming up on The Pulse, one moment your life is fine.
I mean, I was just sitting at the table with my boy, laughing.
And then things change dramatically. That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Overdoses and overdose deaths from opioids and heroin have surged around this region and the country. We've been reporting on local and state efforts to address the problem. For example, first responders and some community members now carry the drug Narcan. If given soon enough, it can reverse an overdose on the spot. In our regular segment, Patient Files, we're going to hear the story of one man who received this treatment, which saved and changed his life.
The last time I was on your guys' station, it was for a couple bank robberies. You guys ran the story when I got caught in 2005. My name is John Dooling, I'm 36. The last time I used heroin, I died. I started drinking and smoking weed at about 14, and guys I grew up around were doing heroin. So about 15, 16, I wanted to be cool with them, so I started doing it. Heroin made me feel perfect. Heroin led me to losing my job, my apartment. I didn't have any anxiety. I was homeless, started getting in trouble, started getting arrested. It made me feel good. I started going to jail. And that's one thing that I never really felt. I went to prison, they had drugs. That wears off and you chase that. Act of desperation. And you just get caught up and then you lose yourself and it takes your soul. I did 5 years. My whole incarceration, I kind of wanted to be sober, get my life together. I had a game plan, like things I wanted to do when I got out. It was July 15th, 2012. The situation for me was I had 4 months clean, so there was no opiates in my system. You think you can shoot like, you know, where you were before. I was at my friend's house, and we, you know, we were just kicking it. We got some money up. We really wanted to get high. We got high in the parking lot, and everything was cool. And I remember sitting at his table eating sherbet. I shot those last two bags. Nah, I mean, I was just sitting at the table with my boy.
It was abrupt.
Laughing, eating sherbet.
It was like a comfortable dream.
I just nodded out.
Like how when you stand up too quick.
And he said, my whole face turned blue, my lips turned purple. And you see, like, all the dots. It was like that. It was bright. He tried to do
something. There was paramedics, police, and nurses.
I felt like I was going somewhere. There was kind of like a map in front of me. And there was like a line, a red line in between. I was moving to a different point. And then, you know, kind of behind it, it was like I was on a turnpike and, like, exits were flying by. It was like I was driving somewhere, like there was a destination I was going to reach. I was going. All those white lights. They hit me with Narcan. Just like waking up, there was paramedics, police, and nurses.
When they started talking to me, it kind of sounded like the Peanuts teacher.
After about a minute and that stuff like wore off, I felt sick. They were like, are you okay? Do you know your name? Do you know what year it is? Do you know who the president is? Just kind of stopped them. And it was just like, yo, hand me that trash can, I'm gonna throw up. Started throwing up. Immediately went into withdrawal.
I said a bunch of foul things.
They told me that I died for about 7 minutes. I died for like 7 minutes, and I was lucky to be alive. I definitely was dead. There was 4 other people that overdosed that night, and they all died except me and somebody else.
I think it saved my life.
There's been moments in my life where I wanted to die and I wished that I would have overdosed, but the funny thing is, when it actually happened, it made me realize that's not what I wanted at all. I thought about my dad and I thought about my mom. I thought about my friends, and I was ashamed of myself. And I felt ashamed of myself, and that's one thing I never felt in my life, was shame. I was ashamed of everything, like robbing the bank, being on drugs most of my life, and I said to myself, like, I'm done. Like, I knew I'd reached the bottom that people talk about that they need to find. And I knew I was done. I knew I reached my bottom. Either I intimidate people, or some people have like that Napoleon complex and they feel they have to challenge me. The side of my right face is tattooed. The side of my head, I have like a prison tower. I have a lot to deal with. The other portions of my head, the fence and the sniper. I'm tatted up. I wish I didn't have any tattoos. The way people look at me, I just wish I didn't have any of them. I got raped when I was 15 by one of my mom's boyfriends. Getting tattooed was my way of like kind of telling the world to like leave me alone, just because of that victimization I felt. On the right side of my face, I have a phoenix. I've probably had that for like the last 2 years. The It goes like all the way underneath my eye, and it's so I can look in the mirror in the morning time and see how far I've came. And I kind of like rose up from the ashes of my past life. I'm in recovery. I've got a few years clean, and I try to stay in the day. I can't really project because I don't know if I'm going to wake up tomorrow. I feel good about myself. I don't regret anything I've done. I look at it as always an experience that I had to experience. I mean, I deal with life now. For me, I gotta kind of stay in that moment because sometimes my brain will lie to me and tell me I didn't have a problem and I wouldn't now, and it'll try to trick me.
John Dooling of Newcastle, Delaware. He is now a community wellness advocate with Brandywine Counseling in Wilmington. That agency is preparing to launch a series of overdose prevention trainings across the state next month. Alana Gordon produced this piece. You're listening to The Pulse. Our next story takes us to the Susquehanna River watershed. This is a big-time destination for fishermen.
Oh, a little smallmouth.
Fishing slow,
he's
right?
Dogging. Yeah, yes, sir.
In Pennsylvania, recreational fishing is a $3 billion industry, and it's threatened because for the last 10 years, a mystery has been unfolding here. The population of smallmouth bass has dropped. Young smallmouth bass have been found with open sores and lesions. Many of the male fish that make it to adulthood have female sexual traits. What's causing these strange symptoms? Katie Culinary spoke with some of the detectives on the case and some people who are impatient with how long it's taking to solve it.
Dr. William Yingling has been fishing for smallmouth bass on the Susquehanna River for 56 years. The retired physician remembers the day in March 2010 when he saw something he'd never seen on a bass before, black splotches on its olive-colored skin.
I looked at it, and the first thing I thought of was that it looked like a mole or a nevus that human beings have. And I thought, well, why did the bass have this?
The black spots are just one of the bizarre symptoms anglers have noticed in some of the smallmouth bass they pull out of the Susquehanna. Starting in 2005, the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission has reported several outbreaks of infectious disease in the young bass that have open sores and lesions on their scales. Researchers have also found intersex fish, adult male bass with female eggs in their testes, since the early 2000s. The State Department of Environmental Protection is studying the mystery and doesn't know what's causing these problems. That irritates some anglers like Dr. Yingling, who believes the culprit is more obvious than the DEP admits.
If we don't limit the amount of chemical pollution going into this river, we're not going to have any smallmouth bass left.
But zeroing in on precisely which chemicals are affecting the smallmouth bass and where they're coming from is proving to be a difficult task for state investigators. DEP biologist Josh Lookinbill steers a motorboat under the Rockville Bridge over the Susquehanna River, just north of Harrisburg. He drops anchor and lowers in a cylindrical water quality meter. Since 2012, the DEP has been trying to figure out if the issues with the smallmouth bass could be signs of a bigger problem in the river. Lookinbill says the department is measuring levels of more traditional pollutants, metals, sediment, and nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus. The agency has also tested the water for more than 200 compounds known as emerging contaminants.
The pharmaceuticals, the wastewater treatment compounds, and other endocrine disrupting compounds.
Scientists are still studying their effects, but these compounds may tamper with the body's hormone systems, and smallmouth bass seem to be especially sensitive to them. Lookinbill says it's too soon for the DEP to name a direct cause for the bass's troubles.
We started sampling them approximately 2-3 years ago, and we're just starting to get results from that. So if there's something to tell about that, it's going to take a little bit of time.
In June, a study by the U.S. Geological Survey found the effects of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals were more widespread than previously thought. Researchers found intersex smallmouth bass in three Pennsylvania watersheds, including the Ohio and the Delaware rivers. but the highest numbers were found in the Susquehanna.
What I think is that the same chemicals that are inducing the intersects are also affecting the disease resistance mechanisms of the fish.
Biologist Vicky Blazer led the USGS study. Over the last decade, Blazer has found intersex bass elsewhere in the Chesapeake watershed, including the Potomac River, where fish were also showing signs of disease. Her research shows there could be a correlation between the high percentage of land used for farming in the Susquehanna watershed and the high number of affected fish. John Arway is executive director of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. In July, he wrote a letter to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency begging for help. He notes Ohio and Virginia have recently passed laws to cut down on the amount of pollution from farming ending up in the rivers.
So this is happening all around us, but we still haven't taken action in Pennsylvania.
Arway has also been pushing the DEP to designate the Susquehanna as an impaired river. He believes that could force the state to take actions that would lower pollution levels and help the bass recover. The DEP says it doesn't have enough data yet to decide whether the river is impaired and suggests the water quality may actually be improving. Arway accuses the agency of dragging its feet.
If I walked into a doctor's office in 2005 and said that I've got sores and lesions on me, it wouldn't have taken 9 years for the doctor to figure out what was causing the sores and lesions.
Last month, state and federal officials sat down to work out a new plan to narrow down the wide range of possible causes for the bass's problems. That work could take at least another year. Biologist Vicky Blazer with the USGS says she appreciates Arway's frustration.
Because I feel the same way, because it's not something that's easy to get a handle on. And, you know, we have fish that are exposed to complex mixtures.
Those mixtures not only include runoff from farms, but also the chemicals from our own lifestyles that are washed into rivers and streams.
So everybody wants the perfect lawn and they spread herbicides all over. And, you know, they're concerned about bacteria, so they're using antimicrobial soaps and other things that have these chemicals in.
Blazer says we need to accept there may not be just one culprit in the curious case of the smallmouth bass, and that we all could be guilty as charged. For The Pulse, I'm Katie Colinari.
Coming up on The Pulse, we hear about a new genetics project that's basically looking for a needle in a haystack.
It's a bit of a moonshot. We don't know what they're going to find, but I think the chance they're going to find something interesting is pretty high.
That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Now, my producers brought me a test tube with a funnel on top. And starting this fall, a million people will spit into one of these, like this. And you close it up, and you mail it away. It's part of a genetic screening project to find so-called unexpected heroes, people whose genes say they should be sick, but they aren't. It's an attempt to develop new treatments for rare diseases. This large-scale genetic treasure hunt is called the Resilience Project, and it's possible now because of advances in genetic sequencing and supercomputing. Carolyn Beeler has this story.
At a March TED Talk in Vancouver, Dr. Stephen Friend introduced the Resilience Project by suggesting that scientists have been looking for new drugs in all the wrong places.
We do a lot of studying of those who are sick, but maybe if what we're trying to do is to develop therapies for prevention, maybe what we should be doing is studying those who don't get sick.
That's exactly what Friend is doing now. The Seattle geneticist partnered with the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai to launch the project. The goal? Test the DNA of a million adults 30 and over for genetic mutations that the textbooks say always lead to more than 100 different inherited diseases. Those include sickle cell disease, cystic fibrosis, and Gaucher's disease.
What we're asking and looking for is, are there a very few set of individuals who are actually walking around with the risk that normally would cause a disease, but something hidden in them is actually protective?
Protective, meaning that some other gene or something else in their history is keeping them healthy.
We know that maybe one in every 25,000 or 50,000 adults is walking around who carries these gene changes, but they're healthy.
That's Alyssa Levin, head of genomics and health innovation at Mount Sinai in New York. She says to find those changes, they'll sequence portions of the million DNA samples they collect. Levin explains what that means.
We are talking about this molecule of DNA, the double helix that we're all familiar with, that is pretty much in every cell in our body. And this is made up of what we call four base pairs. It's A, C, T, and G.
Those A's, C's, T's, and G's make up the recipe for how we grow, develop, and function.
And when we talk about sequencing the genome, we're figuring out at each of the 6 billion places in our genome, what is the specific letter in the code?
At specific locations, if there's an A where there's usually a G on one of those 6 billion places, that's a mutation. It might give you cystic fibrosis or sickle cell disease. Because healthy carriers of deadly mutations are thought to be so rare, Levin's team is only expecting to find about 50 of them out of the million people they test. That kind of genetic needle-in-a-haystack hunt has only recently become possible.
The original Human Genome Project took over a decade to implement and billions of dollars, whereas today, for reference, you can basically sequence an entire genome for thousands of dollars in the matter of weeks.
That's Levin's colleague, Bobby Sebra, director of technology development at Mount Sinai. Sebra says advances in DNA sequencing in the last decade have allowed scientists to comb through DNA samples and find mutations relatively quickly and cheaply. Here, they do it in a classroom-sized lab in Manhattan.
Yeah, right now we're in the Mount Sinai Genomics Sequencing Facility.
Sebra shows me two sequencing machines that look like crosses between a microwave and a dishwasher. One has a Batman sticker slapped on it. The other is Robin.
Are they both equally good? It seems like Batman might be better.
No, they're equal. It depends on which tech you talk to. Each person has their favorite instrument.
Sebra says all a human has to do is load DNA samples into Batman or Robin.
And then to sequence that library only takes about 2 hours.
2 hours compared to about a month of sequencing 24/7 that it would have taken back in the 90s. Given recent technological advances, scientists say this sequencing will actually be the easy part of the project.
I think the hardest part is going to be, once you find those people, figuring out why is it that they didn't develop the disease that they should have developed based on the mutation they have.
That's Dr. Dan Rader, chair of genetics at the University of Pennsylvania.
That's where the real creativity is going to come in. There's going to be a lot of work to try to figure out, looking at other genes and other aspects of those individuals. Why are they so healthy when their DNA says that they shouldn't be?
If the Resilience Project team finds someone with a mutation, they'll ask for consent for a battery of further analysis, looking at the rest of the genome and the patient's medical history to try to ferret out exactly what's protecting them from what should be a genetic time bomb. Whatever is protecting that patient could be turned into a treatment or therapy for people who do get sick. Rader gives an example of how that's worked with HIV in the past.
There was a really well-known story of an individual who basically appeared to be very resistant to the development of HIV despite being exposed.
The patient didn't have a specific receptor, the CCR5, that's required for the HIV virus to get into a cell.
And so that N-of-1 example, which was published in the New England Journal and widely disseminated, I think is a great example of how just one person told us the importance of CCR5 in terms of HIV infection and the concept that CCR5 could be a target for actually targeting therapies.
Rader says the scientific community is largely behind the project.
It's a bit of a moonshot. We don't know what they're going to find, but I think the chance they're going to find something interesting is pretty high.
Mount Sinai is currently retrofitting a 19,000-square-foot DNA sequencing lab in Connecticut to handle Resilience Project samples when they start arriving this fall. Alyssa Levin says the new facility is designed with more of these large genetic treasure hunts in mind.
If we're able to essentially use this as a proof of concept and really make some progress, we're looking to expand out these databases to look at common diseases like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, and applying these models where we know that we're going to have many more people that come up as potential unexpected heroes.
Screening a million samples is expected to take at least 3 years. Mount Sinai is funding the initial stage and looking to private foundations and institutional partners for further support. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
The Resilience Project will start accepting DNA samples through the mail as early as next month. If you're interested in taking part, you can sign up online to be notified when registration opens. There's been a lot of discussion in healthcare lately about how to keep people out of the hospital and curb the use of expensive care that may be better delivered elsewhere or avoided altogether. A study out this month took a closer look at the returns to the emergency room and why patients may come back so soon after an initial visit. As Alana Gordon reports, the reasons may not be what you think.
Dr. Kristen Rising is an emergency physician at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital.
So right now we're walking into the waiting room of the emergency department.
She says researchers often crunch data, but rarely talk to the patients themselves in a methodical way about why they may return to the emergency room for care.
I look at some patients who look like they're struggling so much.
So she conducted 60 in-depth interviews with patients who made 2 visits to West Philly ERs within a week or so. She had expected to hear that patients returned because of social problems, like struggles with childcare or even getting transportation to the doctor's office. But that wasn't the case.
The most unifying thing that they did express, regardless of their specific situations at home, was that they were afraid.
Patients were anxious about symptoms that may not have entirely resolved, or about new ones that surfaced since their last visit.
One patient said, "I don't know what's a stroke, but I know reading up on symptoms that you have or whatever. I said I would rather be safe than sorry, so that's why I wanted to come back to the emergency room."
And while the majority of those interviewed did have insurance and a primary care doctor they liked, they didn't know where else to go for quick answers. The study was limited. It only talked to people who came back to the ER. Even so, it resonated a lot with Dr. Jeffrey Brenner, who's focused on similar questions across the river in Camden.
If a patient believes that something terrible is happening inside of them, it's a fairly reasonable thing in their mind at that moment to go to the emergency room. And we've made emergency rooms very accessible and very easy to go to.
Brenner does caution that what drives health behavior is complex and varied. So he hopes to see more research that builds on Rising's approach and uses sociology methods to go out and learn directly from patients in their own words.
We need to figure out what true north is before you can solve a problem.
But both Brenner and Rising say at the least, the findings point to the need to redesign primary and outpatient care in a way that makes those services more responsive to when and where patients really need them. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Thank you.
listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. How do you feel about mice? They freak me out, frankly. And if you've had the kind of experience where they run through your living room or maybe even across your kitchen countertop, you probably don't like them either, right? But Dr. Elizabeth Becker's research into mouse behavior might change your opinion. Her investigations into how mice parent their young offer insights into the nurture-nature debate. In our regular segment, So What Do You Do?, where lay people chat with scientists about their work, Anthony Stipa, an account manager with Slice Communications, sat down with Becker and asked her,
So what do you do?
I'm a behavioral neuroendocrinologist at St. Joseph's University.
Could you break it down a little bit? Like, what kind of science is behind that?
Sure. I, as a behavioral neuroendocrinologist, am interested in neural and hormonal mechanisms underlying social behavior. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? What is going on in the brain and what's going on in the blood? How are hormones helping to mediate our social interactions?
Now, when did you become so enthralled with mice?
I've worked with other species before, but these mice I'm madly in love with. I work with the California mouse, and they're a very unique species. And they're unique because they're monogamous and biparental, meaning that dads are engaging in parenting as much as moms are. Among mammals, biparental species are actually very rare. Humans are an obvious exception, and it allows me to study paternal behavior, whereas so many other labs can't touch it.
Where does this translate with humans?
I'm interested in how parents shape parental behavior in their offspring. Mm-hmm. So if we go back to the 1970s and the 1980s, and I'm thinking about the discovery of fetal alcohol syndrome, we understood don't do drugs, don't drink when you're pregnant because you can affect your fetus. But what's a little bit more challenging to understand and what I focus on is that care that's provided by a parent can act as a similarly strong stimulus for our own brain and behavior development. So what we show is that dads in particular, in their care for their offspring, are driving long-term changes in their brains and consequently shaping how they behave as parents.
What else makes the California mouse unique? Is it that they like the beach, or is there other traits of them that they enjoy?
What we see in the California mouse is if sons are given high levels of care, and care we measure in retrieval behavior, so that's picking up the pup by its scruff, this is what the dad is doing, and carrying it back to the nest. Now, when you think about that as a behavior in the wild, that's critically important to remove them from dangers outside of the nest. Mm-hmm. The more that that's done, we see that those offspring, those male offspring, as adults, have high levels of arginine vasopressin expression in the brain. Now, what is arginine vasopressin? This is a neuropeptide that's linked to different social behaviors, paternal behavior and aggressive behavior.
Neuropeptide, you said?
Yes. Something that's expressed in the brain, like dopamine, like a neurosteroid, and also in the consequence of higher paternal care. Mm-hmm. So I looked at testosterone early in development to see if that might be that missing link. And what I found was that when a father retrieves his son, he gets a quick surge in testosterone. And this happens repeatedly, we assume, after each retrieval. Mm-hmm. Testosterone is good because it's priming this change in the brain. And that change in the brain is leading to differences in behavior. Species that don't care for their offspring, so those dads that provide zero care, have very low levels of arginine vasopressin expression. So the behavior of retrieving itself, influencing testosterone, is really mediating their ability to be good dads later in life.
Okay, good answer.
When we think about the results that we're getting from these research studies, people mm-hmm. think that those are not generalizable to any population outside of the mice, mm-hmm. meaning that's great,
but it doesn't apply to me.
Yeah. Exactly. But what we see from studies in humans is actually the same pattern. Mm-hmm. And we know this very sadly from studies of abuse, that children who are abused go on to abuse their own offspring at much higher rates than people who are not abused. We also see among suicide victims that those kids that were abused have very similar brain changes that we see in the mice and in the rats. Mm-hmm. So we do get great insights from these research animals into what might be going on in humans, although certainly our social interactions are more complex. So I think it's really critical to understand the consequences of parental contribution to offspring, brain, and behavior. You can think about this in animals or in humans, really, as offspring health. And if we understand those consequences, we can provide support and perhaps prevention for these negative experiences that offspring are having.
That was great. Thank you.
Thank you. You're so good. I can't get over it.
No, I'm some of this over my head, so I'm trying to just comprehend it.
I think your questions are going to help our listeners.
Thank you.
Jeanette Woods produced this piece.
Back to nature now!
Do you want to be part of our So What Do You Do segment, either as a scientist or as an interviewer? Please email us. That's how Anthony got in touch with us, at thepulse@whyy.org. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Gray Tennis is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, or if you have perhaps a long drive ahead, a lot of laundry to fold, a lot of dishes to wash, you can find us on our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. You can listen anytime. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.